Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.
Speakable. This is a space for showcasing conversations about all the interesting and important things the faculty and students are doing at FCAT.
What we hope is to have engaged and informed conversations focused on current issues of the day. Thank you for listening.
I'm your host, Milana Drumeva, and today we're diving into a topic that's on the minds of many. How academia has changed in the post-pandemic world. To help us unpack this, we're joined by the people on the front lines of educational success, teaching enhancement specialists with the Center for Educational Excellence, Sarah Louise Turner and Bea Brigidy.
I'm Bea Brigidy. I work as an educational developer for inclusive teaching at the Center for Educational Excellence, and I teach sessionally for the History Department.
I'm Sarah Louise Turner, and I work as an educational developer in our Center for Educational Excellence.
And you teach.
And I teach as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And you work with FCAT a lot.
I do work with FCAT.
She does.
Yes, I do. Lucky me.
And we appreciate it so much. We appreciate you both so much.
The COVID-19 pandemic brought about unprecedented challenges for universities and students alike. From sudden shifts to online learning, to the reimagining of campus life, the academic landscape has been forever altered. But as we move into this new era, how are universities adapting? 4 years later. Needless to say, my conversation with Sarah and Bea went overtime and will probably be back for more because there is just so much to say. In some ways, it feels like we've been talking about the pandemic forever. And in other ways, it feels like we have just begun to really understand the effects and understand what's changed and be able to pull out what's good, what's bad, what, yeah, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Good, the bad, and the ugly, yeah. And this just really aligns, you know, I was having some conversations with some faculty members yesterday, and you know, we were just talking about also just the complexity of so many different factors aligning sort of all at once, and how too our students, like, and I was bringing my personal kind of anecdote of having a son who just graduated from high school.
Congrats.
And thank you. And it's so great to know, like, he's going to be here in the next few years, right?
Yeah.
And also I had said to him, you know, how was your experience in high school? And he said, I couldn't even call it a real experience. He said, I lost 2 years.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't feel as connected with either the other students or the teachers in the same way that I was hoping that I would have in my high school experience.
Yeah.
I also think that makes sense, obviously, because the experience that students had for the 2 years that we've been through the pandemic, and to some extent we're still trying to figure it out what that meant and what still happens, is that it's a completely different experience of being in a classroom than anything else, right? And I think that while this differences were positive to a larger acceptance of what online teaching and learning is, I think for the student body, though, it was rather harder and less positive than for instruction, right? For the organizers of the educational system, right? And I think it's because we've been preparing as educators for online teaching and remote teaching, and, you know, and we even are open to different ways of approaching classroom experiences, but we haven't prepared students for that change, for that, for any kind of transition, to be honest. And I think that that is positive for our learning as well in universities, to understand that there is a lot that happens within the way we organize, how we teach, and we need the student voice, and we need the student open line of communication consistently, so we can also prepare as a community, right? Not just a community of instructors, but a community of students, a community of learners. And I think that that is why your son experienced what the vast majority of students experience, right?
Yeah.
And he shed so much light into well-being, feelings of isolation, the impacts in learning is just like tremendous. We're still trying to understand how that impacted motivation, which is key for learning success.
Motivation, yes, yes. I'm glad you brought that up, because, and you brought up also a really key distinction, which is that the pivot to online learning, if I'm reading between the lines, was kind of positive for the university, because it's a money saving, more efficient way. Infrastructure savings, definitely a more efficient way to run a learning operation, but much less so for the students. It's a very different learning experience. And there were a lot of student experience surveys, I recall, where students were sharing that they were experiencing that isolation and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, some of us are thinking, gosh, we're going on 2025. You know, surely by now we have shed the effects of the pandemic. But as you're reminding us, Sarah, you know, high school students graduating now who experienced the profound sort of different experience in their last 2 years of high school are just coming in now this fall. So, no, we're not done. We're not even anywhere near done, because what they experienced as a lack in their high school education is actually even more foundational than students who experience some disruption in the middle of their degree. So, it's interesting you mentioned motivation, because on our side as instructors, like, we've seen a lot of students kind of, even though it seems like they hate being at home and being isolated, but they also no longer can motivate themselves to show up and be engaged. Okay, say more.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Just reflecting with a conversation that I had with a faculty member yesterday around that, right? Like that, what draws them in? And I think it's also complicated by this fact of, do they feel, is there enough of a feeling of community and motivation through a community of learners and instructors to propel that movement, right? And to kind of justify that. And I'm also thinking of, you know, I taught in the inner session, and again, like, short, really active course, but many of the students, again, reflected. It was like, wow, I got to hear everyone else's stories in the room, and that motivated me to be here. And I could see the students getting better, like, each week, and that motivated me to be here and support them. And, you know, contextually, these are third and fourth year students. It's, you know, it's optional. Lots of motivation, even in terms of just enrolling for the course. But it was interesting to hear their articulation about what it was that was motivating them to be there every week, and having, like, intensive feedback every moment.
I think what the pandemic also brought to the university as a whole is a sense of questioning the relevance of what we do. And,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Appropriately so.
Yeah. Right? In a really positive way. Yeah. And I think...
But in the critical way, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Question. What is the role of university today?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think students are not apart from that, but they are within this notion. And I think the motivation is driven by finding relevance, right? So I think students are questioning, what is the relevance of my presence in this setting? Why I need to be in person in this place at this time? What is it that I'm going to gain? And I think that why we do have some positive, obviously, you know, supported by data, that students did develop incredible sense of independent learning skills, and that is really great. They also started to question themselves, to what extent I cannot do this on my own. And there are so many people that became self-taught in so many different skills and new technologies, and instructors were taking so much training of different technologies that they've never even heard of before. And I think that, aligned with what is positive, there is also, the questioning of relevance that I feel we haven't yet answered.
Yeah.
Do you know? I think that this is still an ongoing debate. And I think universities have been thinking about this issue of relevance and rigor and role within society for a long time. But I think the pandemic kind of like just put into people's faces, really, like for the entire community, okay, so now is your chance. What is it that you're made of, and why this is so important for all of us, right?
I'm curious, do you have any data? So this was very interesting that is coming out of data that a lot of people have developed, or students have developed, a great sense of, self-learning and are questioning whether they can just do it on their own. I wonder if you've seen data, if there's been an increase in going into other training possibilities in life, like the trades. That's always been like our competitor. And I really agree with you, B. University has never really answered the question of relevance there that well.
Yeah.
But do we have, what happened in your view in the pandemic? Like, there definitely has been a bit of a just general reduction in students coming to university. Where are they going?
I think some of them are trying to reinvent what a career can look like.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what I think. That's what I see a lot. This increase of use of social media to, create niches for careers, and this completely self-made discourse that might or might not be true. Let's be honest, privilege exists everywhere. So I think that is one conversation. But if I'm being honest, I also think that... the vast majority of students who ended up coming to the university at this moment, they are coming with a more realistic understanding of its limitations, right? And I appreciate that, for one. I think that it's a more transparent relationship that universities can have with the student body. Right? Versus promising the world and the sky and the planets and the galaxy. No, it's really the reality and the reality stuff. The marketplace, the job market is really, really tough. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that this is a more transparent and respectful relationship with the student body in terms of recruitment and being in this space. But I also think that what is important to recognize is what I also see with instructors all around, which is undeniably the faculty body became more open to innovation, to flexibility, to conversations that before potentially they would see like, well, this is not part of my job. And they suddenly realize, no, this is actually part of my job. And I do want to try new things in my classroom because I need to motivate my students so they can find relevance for the role that I think that I still have in society, right? So I feel that this is a good moment for gathering all of these forces of these folks really try new things. And start thinking, okay, do we have any way to gather evidence to show the results, the positive results in student learning for what we've tried? And if not, let's figure it out how to do that, right?
Absolutely. And I think it would be interesting to kind of, I don't have that data in terms of like enrollment data comparing what's happening at SFU, say to BCIT or VFS. But I think it would be an interesting kind of lever. I know that even kind of pre-pandemic, Catherine Murray led a little bit of a project sort of assessing what was happening in FAS in terms of where students were feeling like there was a gap in terms of their skills mm-hmm. and what it was that they were needing when they moved out to transition from the university.
Right.
And through that, they then created those intercession courses that they have, the Fast Forward initiative there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more skills-based yep. because that's what they were hearing from students. Not that students wanted to, and I think that this was interesting as well, the data sort of said, you know, they really appreciated kind of the breadth and the depth of the learning experience that they had. But there were some really key pieces that they felt like they needed either to move through their program here at SFU or when they left. And so that was their way to sort of tackle and address those issues as they were emerging. And I think that they found them pretty successful. And I think that what's been really interesting is that then those courses actually appealed to students across the university. It wasn't just FAS students who were participating in them. Right. So I think that says a lot in terms of some of the needs and those kind of wants and desires and opportunities for students both to have voice into how can I shape this curriculum as it's continuing to emerge. And then also how, again, how can I have more flexibility? And I think that, you know, there's a lot of new program creation that's really
yes.
exciting. I know SDA in particular is doing a lot of reimagining many of their core components, right? And I think it's really coming out of that as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question? In your experience, you work primarily with faculty, right? In your experience, are faculty, I have my own thoughts, are faculty excited or scared by the idea of, you know, pedagogical innovation, flexibility, all of these other, you know, additions? Transformations of their teaching?
I think the ones who come to centers for teaching and learning are the ones who believe that they received a training that gave them specific skill sets, but not necessarily the pedagogical framework for them to be able to really showcase the brilliance of their research mm-hmm. and the fantastic ways that they are impacting their own fields, right? So those who have that mindset are, in themselves, a very specific group of people who are rethinkers, folks who are open to try new things, to think in different ways, to look back to their courses and say, yeah, I have been teaching this way, it has been successful, but I'm tired. I want to do something different. Or I noticed that this particular part of my course is extremely challenging and I want to do this in a different way. And I believe that that particular bunch of people, they have already that, sense of they are rethinkers, really. They are by nature. And then we have the group of folks who might not feel necessarily that they need to, the need for rethinking. And I think that it's common for human beings, I guess, in terms of their own nature, is that if they don't have a need to do something, well, then why would they? And that is understandable given the very busy agendas that everyone has and their schedule. So it's not better or worse. It's just like we are not, shaped the same way. We are not wired the same way. And so I do tend to believe that the ones in the centers are the ones we're thinking what they do in the classroom and how they do it.
Actually, and I would add to that too, like the pandemic actually was a really interesting time for us at the center, because what happened is there were a lot of people who didn't have the time before or the kind of the motivation to really rethink. And all of a sudden we started having like a wider breadth of interest and different conversations because of that. And then the other piece that I just want to add to this conversation, too, is also, you know, what I am experiencing and talking to faculty right now is, and this is coming from, you know, really innovative, big rethinkers, a lot of exhaustion.
Right.
Because there's been so much creativity and effort and energy with mounting challenges.
Right.
The challenge of now, how do I address assessments with AI? How do I institutionally, we're being asked to have larger classes, right? So what's happening is that all of that kind of creative energy and kind of fortitude that people brought to the pandemic to really be present and be present for well-being of students.
And for themselves.
And for themselves, right? Is really, I'm feeling that we are at a time where people are maxed out. And I think that because of that too, it's just harder. It's harder to move. It's complex. It's
right.
Very, very complex.
And I think it's because, and I'm sorry if I interrupt. Yeah. I think it's because folks might conceptualize innovation as this I'm gonna have to rethink everything, and it's really not what pedagogical support is about. It's very intuitive in the way that you look into what you've been doing and there is one thing that you feel, you know what, I need to change the first day of my class. I want to talk to my students for the first day. I need them to understand how I am approaching the way that they learn and why. And that, my friends, can be the invitation for motivation, right? That's all we need.
Yeah.
Students were like, oh, boom. It could be that conversation, a lesson planning for one day. We literally put together with the Faculty of Health Sciences, we put together a case study. And it was such a fantastic experience to think about a research subject that is completely out of my historian body. You know, I'm a historian by training. So I'm looking to this. And as an educator, I can help, as you can, and support ways to transform this incredible research into pedagogically sounding activities / assignments. And that was only 2 days of this entire course. So I think the myth of innovation being this huge endeavor is a problem with the burnout, is a problem number one. And the fact that folks think, oh my gosh, I need to know now, I have to self-thought and go on training to do all of these other things to be able to run something in my class. No, you don't need that.
This is such a good point. I really want to emphasize it and repeat it once more, that innovation in pedagogy in one particular course, it doesn't have to be a huge undertaking. It could be changing one assignment, and it could be introducing something in the first week. It could be arranging one activity to try. But I want to ask you about, I interrupted you, B, I'm sorry, but this is a related question. I'm curious if part of the exhaustion, and I hadn't thought about it, but when you said it, I felt it. I felt it. I feel like part of my exhaustion is when you change something in your course, you want to give it time. You need to give it time to land. You need to give yourself time to see, did this really work? And that, unfortunately, like sometimes if your course is only once a year, that means, you know, you wait a whole year to implement it again, or it takes a whole year to do it twice and see if it works. And there have been so many additional challenges, such as ChatGPT and then the budget crisis. And so, yes, having to sort of, part of my exhaustion, and I wonder if you recognize this, is just having to churn out changes faster than you have the time to really assess and reflect on them.
Yeah. I think there is a couple of things that can be done that can be helpful for assessing. I think that the students as partners in the classroom is definitely a huge helper or supporter of assessing and thinking about what just happened, and if it were to happen again, how else could have been done. And I think that imagining students as partners in the classroom is definitely something that saves a lot of time. And I think that burnout basically is not just time in terms of the actual time, but the intellectual time that we have and the energy that we have.
The energy, you know, I've been reading about burnout recently being articulated as, you know, when you're having to expend energy to function in a way that doesn't align with your values. To function in a way that feels disingenuous, that feels like inefficient, and you're just having to do it that way, and that is what burns you out.
Yes.
Not actually the amount of work, not actually the time spent. Sometimes, you know, when you overcome the overwhelmed feeling of innovation has to be a huge thing, and you just implement small changes, it not only could it potentially solve a problem, but it is energizing. And I feel that too. Like, it's energizing to have something that you feel like you've concocted a slightly more efficient way of doing it, or a slightly more, you know, engaging way of doing it. And, you know, and now you hope that it works.
Lots to digest here. We touched on the role of the university and its relevance in society, a question that can definitely be explored further and is always important and material to our project here at SFU. We talked about the experience of pivoting to online teaching and the demands and challenges and opportunities for educators. In the next part of this conversation, we'll return to talk a bit more about the student side of things, again, from the perspective of educational developers and the Center for Educational Excellence at SFU. Tune in, follow, and subscribe.
This has been an episode of Speakable. Speakable is also broadcast live on CJSF, SFU's campus radio at 90.1 FM. If you are a student interested in getting involved, drop us an email and stay updated on FCAT social media and at www.sfu.ca/FCAT.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you want to reduce your impact on climate change, you can start by thinking about what's for dinner.
And it turns out there's a lot we can do in the kitchen.
That's Chef Kathy Caton-Grazzini. She says the biggest step people can take is to eat less meat, because producing it creates a lot of planet-warming pollution. So her new cookbook, Love the Foods That Love the Planet, includes dozens of vegetarian recipes, like arugula pesto, eggplant zucchini torte, and beet burgers. But even vegetarian ingredients have some impact on the climate. So the book includes a breakdown of the carbon pollution associated with key ingredients, and it explains where those emissions come from, whether it's farming, processing, or transport.
What's really driving emissions? Is it deforestation? Is it agricultural inputs like fertilizer or irrigation?
For some ingredients, like cocoa, the way they're produced matters a lot. So the book helps people learn how to identify more sustainably produced options,
so they can make smart decisions, informed decisions about the food we eat.
She hopes the book helps people better understand the impact their food choices have on the climate, and inspires them to make wonderful meals that are better for the planet.
It's a delicious way to really make a difference.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.